Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's September 18th, 2020, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC. And we are 1 week into the NFL season, I guess technically 1 week in a game. And yeah, the first week wasn't too bad. I guess unless you're a Jets fan like myself, it was a brutal game for the Jets. It's probably going to be worse this week. I think the Bills are a better team than the 49ers, but Jets are pretty banged up. Le'Veon Bell, I'm not sure if he's actually going to play again with the Jets. For all I know, he'll be traded by the time he is really ready to come back from a hamstring injury. Jamison Crowder is gone, so not looking too good for the Jets. I guess we'll look a little into next week. You know, first week of the season, there's always a lot of overreactions to things. And, you know, maybe I'm overreacting to the Jets week one performance as well. Except I didn't have a lot of high hopes for them. This was lower than I expected. But, maybe there's time to turn some things around. But, you know, week one of the NFL season, you can read into too many different things. I think you get a lot of you get pulled in a lot of directions based on kind of what you felt going into the season. And sometimes those things aren't true. You know, sometimes you'll see two playoff teams go up against one another. It'll end up being a close game. You'll say, wow, those two teams are going to meet again in the playoffs. And sometimes both teams stink. Sometimes they're both good. Other times they both stink. It's the first week. And this year especially, you know, I think if you have a team that has a lot of new pieces, a lot of new parts that come in, it's going to take you a little bit more time, I think, to mesh together. If you were looking at teams who you would be worried for, just real quick, and we'll get into the running back contracts in just a minute, the new deals that were signed. But I think if you look through this, I think the teams that I'd be a little bit worried about, and again, it's just kind of confirming your own personal biases, I think, at this point anyway. I think Cleveland I'd be a little worried about. I know Cleveland did win against Cincinnati. Their defense did not look good in that game at all. I'm not really sure. Their offense was good. I mean, Baker Mayfield had a decent game, but I don't know. It's Cincinnati. Cincinnati's defense, I think, stinks. They got steamrolled in the first game by Baltimore. The Browns did. There's a lot of chatter, I think, about Odell Beckham again. And I think Beckham is at the point in his career where, you know, you're going to get a game here, you're going to get a game there, and not a lot in between. And that's perfectly fine if you're on a winning team. If you have a personality like Beckham and the notoriety of an Odell Beckham and the team stinks, I think that'll be a problem. And I'd actually wouldn't be stunned if they tried to trade him if things did start to go south for them. Just talking about the Bengals as well, I'd probably be pretty hopeful based on the way the quarterback played last night. That was a nice showing by Burrow in some of the way that he kind of was composed back there and he played. I think things will change there. I think they're forcing the ball to AJ Green right now. AJ Green does not look good, but you know, he hasn't played football in basically a year and a half. So we'll see where that goes. But I think you certainly have to like what you've seen out of the quarterback through two. Just the poise that he's shown. I think that's been pretty good. Eagles lost to football team in week one. That was kind of a stunning upset. Eagles jumped up big on them at the beginning and then just kind of fell apart. I don't think I'd be too worried about that one. I wouldn't be too crazy about the Bills beating up on the Jets. They beat him 27-17. That game should have been a lot bigger. Josh Allen looked good at times, looked really bad at others. He had one pass that was just atrocious. I still think they made a mistake by not signing another quarterback. Jacksonville, they beat Indianapolis 27-20. I think that was a big upset for most people. I thought Jacksonville would get a backdoor cover in that game. I didn't expect Jacksonville to really win that game outright. Phillip Rivers is what he is. He's not great anymore. Jacksonville's got a gamer at quarterback. I think sometimes when you have a gamer, that can really help you, especially if a team maybe overlooks you a little bit. And I think that could be one of the things that was at play there. So we'll see if that goes anywhere. Raiders and the Panthers, high scoring game, 34-30. Vegas takes the win. No defense by either team. I don't know if it's one of these where you say that that's great offense by both teams or really bad defense by both teams. Probably more the latter than the former, but I can't say I saw enough of that game to say one way or the other. Aaron Rodgers had a really good game for Green Bay. You got to be excited about that. Minnesota got thrashed defensively. They did score some points. It seemed to be more kind of late comeback kind of points. But, you know, I don't think anyone expected Minnesota to really go in there and beat up on Green Bay by any stretch of the imagination. And I think Minnesota, most people look at them as kind of like a 500 football team, and that was pretty much how they played. Chicago came back to beat Detroit 27-23. That's a bad loss for Detroit, only because Detroit was up most of that game. That's a nice win for the Bears, because that would have been a really bad start with the way I think a lot of the offseason has gone for them. I think it's a terrible start for the Lions. The Lions are one of those teams where things can probably spiral out of control. And that is the first phase. That's the first step to really having a season spiral out of control, is having a game like that. I think the same goes for Atlanta, though different style of game. They pretty much just got beaten up by Seattle. New England beats on Miami. Ryan Fitzpatrick was back to his intercepting self. Cam Newton had a nice little game. You know, I think they played to his strengths there. 21-11 was the final score. Miami... I think Miami's a better team than this. I think it was just kind of a bad showing. And again, that's one of those teams where you got a lot of new parts that you're trying to integrate in on a team. Chargers beat the Bengals 16-13. Out of that, I think after that second game, one of the things I'd be most worried about is the Chargers' offense. Again, it's 1 week. I think I'd be a little worried about that. You know, I don't know how high people are going to be on Tyrod Taylor. I'm not really big on him. I think Phillip Rivers was probably a better fit for that team than Taylor. I understand why they didn't do it. They wanted to move on. This was the easiest way to make a clean break, is you move to Taylor for half a year, 1 year, whatever, when you have your eyes set on drafting a quarterback. But I'd be a little bit worried about their offense. Saints beat up on the Buccaneers 34-23. Tom Brady did not look good in that game. New team, new parts, new offense. See how it meshes. We'll check back in on that one 2-3 weeks from now. Arizona with a nice little win against San Francisco, 24-20. Most people know I'm not big on San Francisco this year as anything more than being a 500 team. So that was kind of what that was there. There was one really cool play in that. Well, actually, there were two. That Kyler Murray had a run that was just fantastic, I thought, as that game was winding down. But with time running out, Larry Fitzgerald, just so incredibly smart to make sure that they were able to get up to the line and get a ball snapped and, you know, get a ball grounded on that. Just really good. Rams beat the Cowboys 2017. Dallas goes for the win. They didn't convert, there. Ended up not tying the game when they had that opportunity. So that's always going to come under a lot of criticism. You know, that's one of those situations, you're pretty much damned if you do, damned if you don't. I think Dallas try to be aggressive. They try to go for the win on the road, or as much of the road that is as it could be. You know, I don't think you're too worried on that. I don't think the Rams are necessarily a bad football team. So we'll see how that goes there. Pittsburgh had I thought, a little bit better showing than I would have thought for the first week. Their defense looked pretty good. Daniel Jones for the Giants looked good for a little while and then just kind of reverted back into the turnover machine. Denver lost to Tennessee. I didn't watch any of that game, so I don't really have much to say on that whatsoever. You know, Denver missed Sutton in that game, so their offense was kind of incomplete. But I didn't really even catch a glimpse of that to even talk one way or the other on it. But yeah, it was kind of nice to have football back. It was a little bit different with the lack of crowd in the stadiums, but I thought they did a pretty good job with it. You know, I think one of the things when there's no fans there, I think one of the things that the TV will actually learn to do is not do the stadium shots. Those are the ones that look the worst, I think, is when you get these certain angles on there where they kind of get the wide angle of it, and you see just how empty it is and how cavernous the stadium looks. That really does, I think, cut down on like the feel of the game. You know, where you're used to having that crowd that's there. You know, the tracks of the crowds that they used, very different, I guess, depending on where you were. I guess I don't remember who it was, but they had mentioned to me that they're using the tracks from the actual stadium. So I guess that kind of makes sense. You know, what watching the Bills and the Jets, the Bills game sounded like old background noise that you would get in like a Madden game from like 2000, 2005 or something like that. You know, an old NBA 2K game. That was the feel for that. But then when you listen to some other stadiums, I mean, it was pretty lively and had, you know, when they didn't show the stands, had much more feel of, you know, typical football game. So I think they'll get a little better at that over time, and you'll get a little bit more of a football feel when they stop doing some of those shots with the crowds. So as the games kind of came on last week, we had a big rash of extensions coming in once again. And you know, the names that came in here, Brandon McManus got extended. The big ones were Kamara and Cook, and that's what we'll talk about here. Cooper Kupp got a nice deal. I thought that was a pretty decent deal for the Rams. I think Kupp, if he would have had a big year, I think could have scored a much bigger contract than this. They happen to extend Robert Woods today as well. No details of that, but similar price on that. That's a pretty fair extension number, I think. You know, one of the things with the Rams, when you get into deals like the Kupp deal and the Woods deal, when you're talking about 3-year deals, or even a 4-year deal, I guess, but mainly on the 3-year deals, and we look at these annual values. A 3-year annual value is a lot different sometimes than a 5. A 3-year, $16 million a year for Kupp. Kupp's at 15.75. Probably tracks closer to a $14 million receiver, $15 million receiver than a $16 million one in terms of the way it breaks down. Now, you're giving up that year of free agency if he really plays well. But I think the way the league has gone, the majority of those players end up getting extended anyway. So while that helps you with the extension, I don't think it's as big of a deal as people make it. DeMario Davis got extended 3 years, 27. That's pretty fair deal. You know, he's been a big hit in New Orleans. I have a feeling that a lot of this was just salary cap related. You know, if you went, they redid the contract of Rankins basically right on the eve of the season, which told you at that point in time that they were getting ready to extend somebody and they needed the cap room to do it. In this case, it ended up being Kamara. So the big news was the Kamara and Cook deals. So Alvin Kamara comes in at $15 million a year, and Dalvin Cook comes in at 12.6. And the Kamara deal is the one that I think most people were like, wow, you know, he ended up right around Ezekiel Elliott money. And it is one of the most blatantly ridiculous contracts that I've ever seen. When we talk about deals that are backloaded in the NFL, it does happen, but a backloaded deal is something that maybe would do the extent of, I don't know. Let's say that you were doing a $14 million a year contract. And typically, the way a $14 million a year contract would work is you would probably earn something like $18 million over the first year, maybe $16 million over two, $15 million over three, and then 14, 14 is the way that that would kind of break down. And when we talk about a backloaded deal, you know, that $14 million deal might go something like 12, 5, 13, 13, 5, 14. Yeah, something like that, 14, 14. You know, somewhere along those lines. The Kamara deal has a salary in the final year of $25 million. 25 million. I almost didn't want to include it. Every now and then you do see some crazy deals. Like the Saints actually have a kind of a crazy deal on the books already with Jared Cook, that used similar mechanism to this. But that really didn't have to do with anything except rules that were in place that they couldn't have a void year. If the CBA was going to expire, because they would have had that money accelerate into 2020. So they basically put in a dummy year that has a super high roster bonus, I think is what it is in that one, but a really high number that would be due in early March to force them to release him or extend him. So I never included that in the deal. I just looked at that as a void year, and that was, you know, within the rules, that's the way they do it. For this one, it was a little trickier for me, because it's not there for prorating purposes at the moment. Yeah, will the Saints have to redo the deal at some point for salary cap relief? Probably in 2022. You know, there's a probability of it at least. But I included it in there only because everyone is reporting it this way, and it just creates a lot of confusion, I think, if I go out there and I put what's the real value of it. And the real value of this deal really is about $12.5 million a year. Anyone that says otherwise is just kind of full of it. This is the kind of contract that is just designed because you've probably told, if you're an agent, there's two things. You've spent the time telling your client that you're going to get paid like Ezekiel Elliott, and you've spent time pushing in the media that he deserves to be paid like Ezekiel Elliott. And when you're not going to get that kind of contract, and that contract was not going to exist in free agency either, you have to kind of find a way to spin it to make things work. And that was what they did here. And this is another one of those examples, you know, we talked about this before, where you kind of get something in there to dominate a news cycle. And that's the most important thing. The most important thing for anybody when they sign these deals. Yeah, if you're like a super NFL fan, you're coming to a site like OTC to really get into the, you know, nuts and bolts on some of these numbers. But what's your main thing? Your main thing is to have Adam Schefter go out there on Twitter and tweet that, you know, you're the third highest paid running back in the NFL. You know, your goal is to get on ESPN on their flagship program, and whatever their morning program is nowadays, to basically just get a segment on you and how special you are for getting this kind of deal and how it's a huge deal for him as a running back, and it's a huge deal for the Saints, and it proves that, you know, he's going to be with the Saints for X amount of years, yada, yada, yada. That's what you're there for. And then as the numbers kind of come out, you kind of take a more critical, analytical look at it. And the people who are really into it look at this and they go, you know, this is a joke. You know, $15 million a year is a joke. But the majority of it, the news cycle is gone. That's done with. So I think that's the aspect of why you do this. But, I mean, it's a complete bogus bogus contract. The way his deal breaks down is it breaks down right along the lines of the second, don't want to call them second tier guys, but that second class of players, you know, Joe Mixon, Derrick Henry, that's really where it falls into. You can throw, it's below David Johnson. You know, if you look at it, so here is how the Kamara deal is going to break down in terms of new money. So it's 13.7 in new money this year. So by the end of his first new year, he'll have earned 15.7 million. How does that compare with Ezekiel Elliott? Ezekiel Elliott makes 24.7. 24.7 versus 15.7. I mean, there's no comparison when you get there. If you want to throw Dalvin Cook into the equation, Dalvin Cook will make 17.1 by the end of the first year. So this is actually under where Dalvin Cook wound up. This is under Joe Mixon. Joe Mixon's at 18.8, and Henry is at 15. So essentially, I would say that this played off of, at least for the first year, was just finding a way to earn a little bit more than Henry did. Through year two, as you get into these, Kamara's at 27.2, Dalvin Cook's at 26, Henry's at 25.5, Mixon 27.5, Le'Veon Bell's at 28, David Johnson's at 30, Zeke is at 37, Christian McCaffrey is close to 40. So again, we're nowhere in the ballpark of those big number deals, but right on target with that $12 million range contract. we get to year three and we say, okay, is year three the year where it makes that turn into being like a true, true contract like these other guys? Not really. So he's at 38.2. Dalvin Cook will be at 37. So Dalvin Cook's makes a little bit more of a turn. So Dalvin Cook gets a nice year one. He makes a little bit more of a year turn if he makes it to year three. Derrick Henry was at 37.5 through 3 years. Joe Mixon's at 37.6. Kamara's 38.2. He's still under David Johnson at 39. Le'Veon Bell at 39.5. Zeke is at 48. McCaffrey's at 51.8. Again, no comparison. Year four, we got 49.5 for Dalvin Cook, $50 million for Derrick Henry, $48 million for Joe Mixon, Kamara, $50 million. 52.5, Le'Veon Bell, so he's under that. He's under Elliott's 58. He's well under McCaffrey's 64. So really, you have to wait until you get to this fifth year where you throw in all that bogus money, which really doesn't mean anything. You know, you're not going to pay a running back $25 million at any point. But that's the year in which the contract kind of makes the turn, you know, to at least be somewhat in line with the Ezekiel Elliott contracts. Dallas will have much more sunk in Ezekiel Elliott to where if there's any kind of productivity left at that point in time, maybe he has a chance of earning year five. You know, and you can say, well, you know, the bigger thing here is he got the fifth year. Now, I almost think that they would have been better off when you look at the cash flows on this. They would have been better off probably looking for something that has a little less injury protection and trying to do a three-year contract that would have come in at $12 or $13 million and get him to free agency when maybe he would still have a chance to pick up another deal. You know, the 4 years, 5 years, that doesn't make a difference when you're running back. If you could have gotten a two or a three and still gotten your $13 million or your $12 million a year, I think even though you wouldn't have gotten that dominating news cycle, you would have had a better contract for the player. You would have had a better possibility to earn more money. Cook, you know, maybe somewhat similar. I don't think Cook has the name value of Kamara, which is one of the big things there. As for all these deals, you know, again, it just amazes me the way that teams kind of fall for this running back trap again at this point. I made this comment on Twitter and I stand by it. When Todd Gurley signed that deal a couple years ago, it showed you just how screwed up sometimes some of these NFL teams are, because it was as if people were just waiting for permission to go and spend big money on a running back. Because if Gurley doesn't do that deal, if Ari doesn't get that deal done for Todd Gurley with the Rams, you know, Todd Gurley probably is going to fall down with the Rams, never get the big extension. He doesn't get that deal. David Johnson doesn't get that big deal. Le'Veon Bell probably isn't going to get that big deal. And now you're talking about, well, what does Dallas do at that point with Ezekiel Elliott? Because if there's no other numbers, if there's no other players on the books when Zeke gets to the point where he's going to hold out, it's like, well, what does Dallas do at that point? There's not a lot of precedent to say that the running back market is worth much anything. But the Gurley deal changed the dynamic because it led to David Johnson, which in turn led to the Jets doing the Bell deal, which led to Zeke, which led to McCaffrey, which led to whomever. And I just don't understand why teams continue to fall for this. The running back, it's not even that the running back position is or isn't important. All right. You know, we can have that debate about replaceability and actual efficiency in the professional game itself. How much does it exist? Are you better off without it? Let's say that the running back is incredibly important. Let's just pretend that stuff doesn't even exist. Even if we want to say that the running back is incredibly important, history has shown us that the running back breaks down. So even if you want to say the running back is incredibly important, well, then that means that it's important to draft a running back. That means it's important to draft Christian McCaffrey. It's important to draft Ezekiel Elliott. It's important to draft Le'Veon Bell. It's important to draft Saquon Barkley. It's important to draft these players and then draft again in 4 or 5 years, not to go and spend 14 or 13 or 12, however many millions it is on the players when they're going to break down. They're just not going to live up to these contracts. Now, the one thing that these teams have done better, again, for the most part, and these deals, I think, fall into that category. The Gurley deal was really bullish on the guarantee aspect, and I think teams have pulled back on that. So there is a little bit more leeway in terms of cutting them. But still, you know, do you want to pay $17 million for Dalvin Cook for basically an extra year and then turn around and cut him when you could have franchised him for probably like 8 or 9? That's bad business. That's not good for your team. So I don't know why they keep falling down this rabbit hole. This is exactly what happened 15 to 20 years ago when the one back system in the NFL was a bigger deal, obviously, than it is now, and was probably more impactful on your teams. You know, your Sean Alexanders, your Clinton Portis, you know, Marshall Faulk, you know, all those guys. You know, even like Priest Holmes, who was dynamic for a while there, Larry Johnson, Curtis Martin, so many of those players. And most of them got big deals. A couple of them, you know, played well until they were older. I mean, Curtis Martin played for a long time. But for the most part, they all fell apart. Even if you went to the more recent ones, you know, the last group to score bigger contracts relative to the cap at the time, you know, your Arian Fosters, he was always hurt. He was great when he played, but he was always hurt. Ray Rice was terrible. Absolutely terrible after signing those deals. DeMarco Murray, awful. You know, it's like you there's so much of a history here. And every time that these deals get signed, everyone will come out and they'll say, well, you know what? Not my guy. Well, guess what? Every one of those other teams said, not my guy. And guess what? It's all their guys. So I don't understand why they keep kind of falling for this. But I almost feel as if we're now going to have to get a whole generation again of flops. I'm going to guess that the pinnacle of it will be when Barkley gets his extension. And then we'll see how he does. But I almost feel as if you're at the pinnacle of a cycle. And now you're going to see a couple of kind of flops pull in here. Now, if you're the Bengals, you say, okay, I got a rookie quarterback. I don't care. You know, if I'm paying Joe Mixon $12 million, who cares? I got a rookie quarterback. I can at least buy that a little bit. I can buy the Jets with Le'Veon Bell with a rookie quarterback. It's much harder to buy the Cowboys with a 30-something million dollar quarterback or a $40 million quarterback. Dalvin Cook with a $33 million quarterback. Alvin Kamara with who knows what they're going to have at quarterback. You know, it's hard to buy those kind of decisions. You know, Derrick Henry with a $28 million quarterback. I can kind of get McCaffrey a little bit. You know, the quarterback's around 23, but even that's iffy. You just got to be smarter. And, you know, too many of these teams aren't. You know, it just surprises me. I mean, someone like a Kamara, and the Saints are in a win now mode. Maybe that's a bad example. But somebody like if they're at a peak, if you took someone like a Dalvin Cook, I bet Dalvin Cook's got a decent trade value. You know, you could probably get something back from him if you send him to a contending team in the middle of the year. That's better than doing this, I think, at least. You know, now, if you're rewarding a player for the fact that they gave you four good years and they weren't, you know, paid accordingly, okay, more power to you. There's very few teams that are doing that. So that was the biggest extension stuff. The other big news, I guess, was Allen Robinson, the Bears, not looking to extend him, reportedly at least. And it looks like it's getting a little bit ugly. Reminds me a little bit of the Jamal Adams stuff. Allen Robinson pulled off his the Bears from his social media account. And there was rumors that he asked for trade. Then he said he didn't want to trade. I think it was Dan Graziano said that they basically have offered him, I'm going to say it's like 15 a year, 16. Basically, it sounded like the same price that he's at now. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. He certainly earned a raise. I mean, when they took him, he had come off a down year and then a hurt year. So everything was pretty bullish on that one season that he had in Jacksonville and his ability to bounce back from an injury. And I think he's been better than you would have expected. So generally, you would get a raise for that. Not just that, the market's gone up a little bit. So I think you've proven yourself to be a legitimate number one, certainly for that team where he dominates target share. And yeah, your legitimate number ones are basically $18 million a year players. You know, Keenan Allen getting a 20, I think kind of raises the bar. And you look at free agency and you say, well, you know, is Kenny Golladay going to get there? Because if Golladay gets there, well, you could probably get there. So it's kind of one of those situations where it could probably get messy. And maybe the Bears didn't handle it right in terms of explaining what they're doing to him or how they look at it. Is it the right business decision for Chicago? Part of me says yes. I think the Bears are basically at a crossroads right now, right? I think we all can kind of agree at that. You know, they need something, a miracle to happen kind of with the quarterback position to make a leap. And they did spend money this year. It's not like they didn't, but they didn't go crazy. You know, I think some people feel as if Chicago went crazy spending and then they don't want to spend any money on Robinson. And that's not really true. I mean, they were pretty much an average spender. And my thought on this is what Pace probably looked at is, you know, he's, I would think, on the hot seat. So you would think that this is kind of a season where his job hangs in the balance. And I would think they probably looked at this and said, well, you know, we can either add a couple of parts or, you know, we can kind of keep status quo and keep everybody happy in the locker room. And I don't think that's the way to you know, necessarily approach it. You know, or a bad way to approach it, I should say, what they ended up doing. Now, you can question who they signed. A lot of people forget, you know, we get so wrapped up in salary cap numbers and salary cap impacts. All these teams have budgets. All right, they all have money that they can spend each year and money they're not supposed to be able to spend each year. You know, usually you can look at historical patterns and every now and then you do get some outlier years, you know, the Texans this year, the Cowboys this year, those are way, way, way outside their norms. Those are typically two of the, most cost conscious teams. And this year, not even remotely close to that. Chicago has been kind of all over the map a little bit, but if you're an owner of a franchise and you kind of have a budget in mind and, you know, you can do some leeway here and there, but do you want a guy who might not be here next year making those kind of big decisions? And I think what it came down to, and again, I'm not saying that it's the right one or the wrong one, but I think what it came down to is that they looked at guys like a Danny Trevathan, who they re-signed, and they looked at him and said, okay, he's just resigning for the same amount. So we're just looking at this as basically extending his current deal. You know, it's going from a 7 to a 7 to a 7, you know, or whatever his number is. And I think they looked at this and they said, hey, look, we got Nick Foles on the cheap. This is a dude who went for 20-something million last year. We got him to agree to a pay cut. He's like a $6 million a year quarterback for us, best backup in the NFL. You know, he gives us a good option if Trubisky stinks. And I think they looked at Quinn and they said, you know, we can use another pass rusher. You know, if we're going to make one leap of faith deal, we want to make it on that one because does it make more sense to spend on Robinson? Maybe it does, but where the Bears are, they can't go back in there with the same exact thing as they did last year. You know, they're going to go 8-8. Now I think they're going to end up going in something like 8-8 anyway, but you at least take a chance by changing the mix a little bit. And I kind of have a feeling that that's what went on there. Robinson is a good trade chip. You know, if things do go bad, you would think you can get a nice little haul for him. Even if it's not this year, next year, you know, you can franchise tag him. You can do the same thing. You can kind of look to trade him then. But what I think is bad about the Bears with it is it sounds like they did make him an offer. And that offer kind of sounds like it falls more in the lines of what the Trevathan deal was, that it's just kind of like, well, it's like an extension of your old deal. You're happy at 15. We're happy at 15. Let's keep going at 15. And that's not going to cut it. And it's like, you know, if you want him, you do have to put a best foot forward effort. And you can't tell me when Cooper Kupp signs for 16 and Robert Woods is signing for 16 that you can offer your guy less than that. You know, you've got to be able to offer him more money than he was playing on before. And if you're not going to do that, you know, if you're not going to even come out right from the start and say, okay, we're going to bump you to 16.5. Let's say they don't want to get to 17. We'll bump you to 16.5. You know, at least that's kind of a starting point. And that can kind of give you even a sense to say, look, this is the best we can do. We don't want to get into a long-term deal. A good chance we're bringing a rookie quarterback next year. We have a rookie quarterback. Who knows what we want to do there? Do we really want an established receiver that's going to be on a third contract? Or do we want to, just get younger overall? You know, that's fine. But when you offer that extension and it's kind of a low ball, I think that kind of sets things, it gets things out of sorts. So I think they just kind of have to solve that problem a little bit, before they move on, because he's the best player on their offense, and they have to find a way, I think, to make it work, make it work out. Let's take a look at the games this week. Just doing my little sports line pool. So I have no idea where the spread is on these games right now. I had taken Cleveland. So I had gotten Cincinnati on that one. So I had gotten the backdoor cover on that. So we've got the Giants at the Bears. Speaking of the Bears, Bears are 5.5 point favorites. I think I would... that's a little high for Chicago, but I think I would take them because Jones is so turnover prone. I think the defense can put up a touchdown. If defense puts up a touchdown, that's pretty much all she wrote. Tennessee is a 9.5 point favorite against Jacksonville. I think that's way too high of a line. I would take Jacksonville again. Again, I'm not saying Jacksonville is going to win. I just like them on the cover on that. I don't think Tennessee is a very imposing team. Detroit is at Green Bay. Green Bay is favored by 6.5. Big game for Detroit. I think I'd like Green Bay here. Lay the points. Carolina travels to Tampa. Tampa's a 9.5 point favorite. I would go with Carolina. Just kind of a stab there. I not enough out of that Tampa offense last week to say that they're ready to beat a team by 10 points. Do I think Tampa Bay will win that game? I do. But maybe by 7, maybe by 8. I don't think by 10. Atlanta travels to Dallas. Big game for both teams. Dallas favored by 4.5 points. Atlanta's got to go on the road. I've said it before. I think if Atlanta gets off to a bad start, it's just a really bad sign for that team. I like Dallas to win. 4.5 is a little bit on the high side, especially because we know Atlanta can score. I think I'll take Dallas and drop the 4.5. San Francisco goes to the Jets. Jets get 6.5 points. I don't like San Francisco at all, but man, the Jets are so bad. I'll take San Francisco, I think, and lay the 6.5 on the road. Even though, man, the receivers in these games are going to be terrible, but San Francisco will probably screen the Jets to death. Probably do well in that regard. Minnesota at Indianapolis. Indianapolis favored by 3.5. I like the Vikings to win outright. Rams at Philadelphia. This is basically a pick 'em game. I think the Eagles will have a good game off of last week's loss there. So I'll take the Eagles to win. Buffalo goes to Miami. Miami gets 5.5. I don't think this one's a good matchup for Miami. I think Buffalo, the only question I would have is Buffalo going to make mistakes with the football that Miami can maybe capitalize on? Maybe they can. You know, that's kind of a tricky one. You know, they have the guys in the secondary, I think, to really to cover those receivers. And then they can keep Allen from running around, because that was one of the best parts of Allen's game last week. It's a tough one. I think I'm going to take Buffalo. I may end up changing on that as I look more at that game, but I think that's pretty close on the line there. Denver travels to Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's a 6.5-point favorite. I'll take Pittsburgh. Washington goes to Arizona. Arizona's a 6.5. I think Arizona will clock the Redskins, the former Redskins there, the football team. Kansas City goes to the Chargers. Chargers get 8.5 points. That's a lot of points for a divisional game. I just don't like that offense at all from LA. I'll take Kansas City. Baltimore goes to Houston. Houston looks like they're getting 6.5. I'll take Houston. I think Houston can win outright. Houston's a weird team. Houston can, you know, really bounce back in a lot of these games. I think Houston has a chance. Houston's either going to get killed. It's same thoughts that I had in the first game. Houston's either going to get killed, I think, or they'll be competitive enough to win outright. I'm going to take them to win this one outright. New England goes to Seattle. Seattle's a 4.5-point favorite. I think Seattle will just romp them. New Orleans, Vegas, 5.5 points. They're going to be playing in the Death Star there. I'd be surprised if New Orleans does not win and cover. The only thing that worries me here is the Saints lose Michael Thomas. At least I think he's out. You know, Thomas is such an integral part of that offense. Breeze does not have that arm anymore to do a whole bunch of stuff. I think Thomas is the perfect complement for him with the way he runs his routes. And that I think is going to be a big loss for them. But I'll take the Saints anyway in this one, just because I'm not that high on the Raiders when they're going to go up against a team like this, because I think the Saints defense is pretty good. So I think the Raiders will have a difficult time moving the football. So before we get to your questions, just as a note, we do have our player valuations up online now. So if you're a subscriber, you'll be able to basically get the values for the players that we come up with each and every week, as well as seasonal totals there. On the free end, we do them every now and then. We'll put the week totals on there. I'm not sure if we'll do it every week. We did it every week last year. The first week is up there. If you go to overthecap.com/valuation, I think it's the page. You can always find it, I think, in the other features if you click on that. And you can always go to you know, a player's individual page if you're just interested in one player. I think the important thing to note with the valuations is the valuations are not a free agency valuation. And people ask me about this all the time. It's not that at all. That's something completely different that you would look at. Basically, this is a way to kind of reassess the way teams spend money every year, you know, on their rosters. And if you redistributed that money based on certain performance metrics, how would it go? And basically, the way that it primarily works is we look at participation, you know, which is very valuable. We look at a Pro Football Focus grade. And I know a lot of people will say, well, you know, the PFF grades aren't worth that much. And, you know, you can argue back and forth about the how good that they are. But, you know, it's kind of a, I don't know, almost like a scouting component that goes into it. And then the other thing we do is we look at certain statistical performances and how they compare with other players around the league. And league averages, expectations, typically using PFF stats that we're able to utilize in creating this. And it basically creates a system where you can kind of spit back values for a week and on a season. You know, some people look at these numbers and they'll say, well, you know, how can this guy not be worth this much more? And, you know, typically that happens with the quarterbacks. And part of the reason for that is when you do have a lot of rookies who are putting up the biggest numbers at a position, obviously that they also drive down the overall salary pool. So typically the way that it works is, you know, rookies are way underpaid and your veterans are overpaid when you compare them to what a rookie makes. So it kind of makes it hard sometimes for certain players to live up to their annual value. You know, it would be very difficult, you know, for Patrick Mahomes to have a $45 million valuation when the quarterback market is basically 45, 39, 35, 34, 33, 32, 28, you know, 27, 23, and then it's like 8 million, 7 million, 6 million, 5 million, 2 million, 4 million. So when you put those all together, that's how you come up with the numbers. Now, most of the teams will value over their overall annual value, and that's because we do bump the numbers a little bit to try to eliminate some of the $0 contributors. You know, we'll bump them up to basically being worth a minimum salary at the very least on that. But you can read about them on OTC, and you know, I'll post about them each week, but that's what those valuations are. So if you click on a player's page and you see an OTC valuation, that's basically giving you an idea as to if we just reassigned all the dollars this year, where do we think that that player would be, you know, where should he wind up? You know, how much should he be worth, you know, within that framework? If you wanted to look at it as a free agency tool, you know, there's a lot of other things that go into free agency. But if you want to look at it, you know, as a rough guide, I would say for a lot of players, you know, you want to bump those numbers by a couple million bucks. And that's closer to a free agent number because you're going to overpay for those players in free agency. You know, but I think it's just kind of a fun way to, you know, view some of these teams and view some of the players and just see how they do. So you can check those out. Again, I think it's overthecap.com/valuation. Let me just check it out. I'll make sure I have the address right. And again, this is the free one for week one that you can see. And just to give you an idea, we had Aaron Rodgers at 40.2, Dak Prescott at 36.8, Matt Ryan 36.7, Wilson 36, then Murray 33, Josh Allen 32, Tannehill 31. You know, if you went to your next groupings, you had Joey Bosa was the top defensive player worth about 25. Chase Young at 24.4 was, you know, your top rookie. Aaron Donald, 22.7, TJ Watt, 21.7, and so on and so forth. And there's some different ways that you can, you know, sort through them. You know, Patrick Mahomes, we had at 27.2, so that's obviously way under his thing. Kenny Clark, you know, got beat up, basically. I think he got hurt in the game. Didn't really play much, so really didn't give you much there. We just bumped his overall up to 6'10 because he played. DeMarcus Lawrence did not have a good game. Carson Wentz, you know, not a good game. So that's what that is. So you can check him out if you want. If you have any questions, feel free to email me. And, you know, as usual, I'm behind on emails, but I'll get to them eventually. So let's get to your questions. Then we'll call it a night here. So let me just pull up the questions that I asked for earlier today. Looks like we have 8. All right. Maybe less. Maybe 7. So Chad asks, will teams that have available cap space in 2021 have a unique opportunity to take bad contracts off teams that are in rough situations hands, like an Osweiler type deal? I don't think so. I guess it depends on how the deals are structured. You know, the Osweiler deal, I guess... You know, it had a high paragraph 5 guarantee. So basically, you'd have to find a team that didn't use much of a signing bonus, because it's the signing bonus that's really going to drive the dead money on a deal. You know, if you're looking at a trade to see if that's a worthwhile exit, you know, for some of the teams. My guess is it won't happen that much. I kind of think that the teams that have a bunch of cap room are going to look at next year as an opportunity to really exploit free agency. You know, as I've said many times, star players, I think, are COVID proof. But I think all those players that are in the 7 to 9 million range that, you know, might get bumped down next year to 4 or 5 or only be offered 1 year contracts, I think that they're the teams that have that cap room are going to be able to exploit that and kind of use things to their advantage to, you know, maybe pay them more up front, front load more in terms of a cap deal. I think that that's more what they'll do. Chad also asks, does the declining cap make the salary cap real again? Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you know, the salary cap is real, but the thing is that the teams have just gotten so good at managing it, and the agents have let the balance of power shift so much back in the team's favor. You know, in the past, it really was in the agent's favor. Now it's shifted much more to the team side, and the teams do such a good job. What's really happened is that you don't have many situations anymore where teams face like a doomsday year. You know, the Saints are kind of a doomsday year next year. You know, the Steelers are nearing a doomsday. The Eagles maybe one day could have a doomsday. I think they have flexibility, but you never know. You know, there's a handful of teams. But for the most part, the rollover process and the contract structures and that kind of stuff have made the salary cap much more idiot-proof. Losing the original rookie contracts also helped because those were much harder to deal with on your cap with the way those broke down. So I think the declining cap definitely will help to some extent in terms of making the cap, I guess, more of a thing for competitive balance again in the NFL. And it really hasn't been that way for a couple of years. John Hayes says, maybe you've already touched on this and I haven't seen it, but what does the Kamara extension do to the Saints cap situation next year? And what options might they have? So I did a whole podcast on the Saints, so you can check that out in the archives on OTC. I'm sure it's listed there. It was so long ago. I don't know if Apple keeps that in their list. They probably don't. Maybe some of the other ones do, but you can find it on OTC. Let's see, Saints cap room next year, I think. So the way that they did that deal, there's very low cap numbers on the front end. You know, they're reasonable cap numbers. So they didn't lose a ton with that deal. So let me just see where they're at. 21. They're about 83 over effective cap room. Now, before the Kamara and DeMario Davis deal, they were around 77 or so over, so that they didn't really add that much between those two contracts. But the short answer is, you know, when you look at them next year, they're going to have to get very creative with Drew Brees, assuming he's going to retire. They have to renegotiate his deal to carry it during free agency so they can post June 1 him. You know, other things that they're going to have to do, you know, you might restructure Cameron Jordan. You might restructure Michael Thomas. You got to extend probably Marshawn Lattimore. I don't know what you do with Taysom Hill. That was just crazy. You know, cut your punter. I doubt they're going to cut their kicker. Cut Janoris Jenkins. Cut Latavius Murray. Cut Emmanuel Sanders. Well, Sanders still has a guarantee. Jenkins has a guarantee too, I think. You know, but you might have to eat some of that. You know, I think that's what you're doing. You're going to slice and dice some of these players on here. You know, if you don't extend Lattimore, are you going to trade him? Now, you've got the two rookies. You know, I would think, you know, that you can get deals done, certainly on the tackle. But, you know, maybe you look to trade somebody. But, yeah, they're going to have to really gut the roster and do a lot of restructuring next year. The official Jalen Hurts fan group. What are some moves you think the Eagles can do to get under next year's cap? So I think the big ones are you cut Alshon, you cut DeSean Jackson. You extend Fletcher Cox and you restructure Carson Wentz's deal. I think you do those couple of things and you're probably in the ballpark at least of being okay with the cap, if not under the cap at that point. You know, might the Eagles look to trade Zach Ertz? I think that's a possibility, I guess, as well. You know, if they trade him or cut him, you know, they gain 4.7 next year. I don't think you can rule that out. I'm just looking to see anybody else. You know, I've done a whole podcast on this one as well. So you can check that one out in the archives where we go over a lot of these deals. But off the top of my head, those are the main moves that I think they would look at. Brian T. says, do you think the Jets will restart this offseason with Douglas at the helm and a new head coach and quarterback if this season continues to falter? I'd be very surprised if Adam Gase is the head coach next year. I would be pretty surprised if Sam Darnold is the unquestioned starter next year if the Jets finish 4 or 5 wins or less, unless he really lights it up at some point. Sam Darnold does not look like a high-quality NFL quarterback. At the best, he looks like a average to below-average starter in the NFL, and that might be being generous. I mean, right now, if you watch Sam Darnold as a Jacksonville Jaguar, you'd probably say he's Blake Bortles. You know, I think that maybe there's still a little something there, but physically he doesn't seem as gifted as a lot of these other guys. Game doesn't seem to come to him naturally at this point. Yeah, he's really young. So maybe there's something that's there. I think the bigger takeaway I would have is maybe drafting a quarterback that young is maybe not the wisest of decisions. As for Joe Douglas, you know, so I think that they'll stick with Douglas. I think the only thing that could happen, and we're already seeing the media start to turn negative, not so much on Douglas, but on the roster for the team. I think there's questions as to why they didn't spend more to fix the team this year. Jets do have one of the lower payrolls in the NFL. I think people look at this as, you know, why didn't they, you know, go out, you know, why didn't they get aggressive to try to get a pass rusher? Why didn't they get aggressive to get a receiver? You know, and it doesn't help that the second round pick is on the Devin Smith track rather than a better track. But I think unless Douglas has a John Idzik kind of meltdown, if you remember John Idzik, he did this crazy press conference back in 2014. Is that his second year? Yeah, I think it was 2014. It was so absurd and so awful. From what I understood, he thought he was set up by the team. When he wrote this thing himself, and it was a disaster because Rex Ryan had been set up the whole year to be the fall guy, and Idzik was looking at this as a situation where they would fire Ryan, Ryan would take the blame for the bad season, and Idzik would get to make over the team really in his image. And you know, I didn't think very much of John Idzik's 2 years that he was there. You could argue that it would have been fair for him to you know, get an opportunity with someone besides Rex Ryan, who is, you know, just a very dominant personality, probably a little bit difficult to maybe to work with if you're not coming from that same kind of thought process. But Idzik basically did this mid-year press conference, which took all the heat off Rex Ryan and put it on John Idzik. And Idzik had no hope. That was when they started coming with the banners saying, you know, John Idzik's got to go and all kinds of crazy stuff. So I don't think that's going to happen to JD. But I can't completely rule it out. But I think that he'll be able to kind of get through this. But if they have a bad season, you know, let's say the Jets have a 3-win season or a 4-win season, I think he'll be on thin ice the next year, even if we're talking about him. See, the way the Jets work, they're not going to let him hire a coach. It's going to be a group decision, which means he'll be part of an interview process. But it's really going to be ownership, you know, making the decision, and, you know, other executives within the team having big input on the position, probably more so than Douglas. You know, so I think, you know, he's probably put himself, I think he's accelerated his own timeline in terms of needing to really improve this team with some of the moves that he's made in the last year and a half. You know, some of the stuff he did last summer didn't work out, which is going to come back negative when people start to look at him now. But again, it's one game, so let's hope that things get better. NY Rangers news. Does Gase have a great offensive mind? No. I don't know where this thought is that Adam Gase is a offensive genius. His offenses generally have been terrible, except for the one with Peyton Manning. So I don't know where it comes from. You know, maybe that's the bigger problem with the Jets, is their owners are swayed way too much by people who are respected around the league. You know, Peyton Manning clearly swayed them, I think, on the Adam Gase decision. You know, the Casserleys and Polians of the world have clearly pushed the Jets in certain directions. I'm not saying those guys don't have a place. They certainly do. They all do. But I think sometimes, you know, when you get into some of the older GMs and stuff, sometimes the game is passed them by, especially when you're not in the game anymore specifically. When you're in the game as a sort of a consultant and a kind of a media personality, sometimes you don't know the way the things have changed. And I think that the Jets have fallen for that kind of stuff too much. And, you know, and maybe that's just from the owners, even though they've been around for so many years now, it's hard to say they're not football people anymore. But, you know, it's even when you go back, I mean, they would rely a lot on Parcells, even after Parcells was long gone, you know, for input on people. So, you know, that's one of the bad things, I think, with the Jets right now. But Gase, I don't know. This is your Rich Kotite moment. You know, if you are younger, you know, if you are in your, I don't know, the Kotite was the coach in, what, 95? You know, it probably wouldn't have sunk in for you how bad Kotite was unless you were at least 15, maybe. You know, so you'd have to be pretty close to 40. I'm trying to think of how young you could be and still have gotten what Kotite meant. Like how bad that really was. Because this is pretty much Rich Kotite. This is Kotite 2.0. You know, when he came in. And that's really what this is. So, I don't know. This is your Kotite moment. I said, you know, you've kind of been waiting, because this is... you know, when I grew up and I was little, you know, obviously during the 80s version of the Jets, and, you know, as a little kid, you know, the Jets during that period were like, you know, they would show you some promise. You know, they had a couple of those years with Ken O'Brien where they did well. And then it was like this black period of Joe Must Go with Joe Walton and people showing up with the bags on their heads and everything. And then that led to Bruce Coslett and then Pete Carroll for a spell. And, you know, it was just like it was a living hell if you were a Jets fan, right? Even when you were little, you know, it was like a living hell. You know, you just couldn't figure out how your team every year could be this bad. You know, and then after a while, you know, you get older and you still see this stuff going on. And, you know, that's where the Kotite stuff kind of came in. You know, you get past those younger years where you look at everything with the rose-colored glasses, and you've just been beaten up at this point. You know, and you're however old you are then, and you know, late teens or whatever, and you're beaten up by this, and then the Kotite thing happens, and it's like that's when you've hit rock bottom, and you know, maybe this is the Jets' Kotite, maybe this is this era's Kotite. You know, you've gone through. Maybe the Idzik and Maccagnan eras were more along the lines of the Joe Walton era and the Bruce Coslet era. Maybe that was more the tail end of Rex and the couple of years of Todd Bowles in there. And now we've hit the Kotite era. It's pretty bad. Black Gold, what does a realistic contract for Allen Robinson look like in a sign and trade type deal? Cooper Kupp numbers or Keenan Allen numbers? I think Robinson's going to look for Keenan Allen numbers. I think he's so important to the Bears offense. I think there is more of an ability for him to reach for that. He's also, you know, he makes some incredibly athletic plays on the field out there. So I think he'll reach for Keenan Allen numbers. I don't know if he'll get Keenan Allen numbers. He's going to get more than Cooper Kupp, I would think. I'd be pretty surprised if he got under that. I think that he probably should settle in the 18 range, just like a whole bunch of people. But I think he'll push for 20, and I don't think he'll get there. But it's not crazy for that to be the case. You know, if you were going to trade for him, I think what you would want to do is you would want to have that conversation about extending him, and I think you would, again, put best foot forward. You know, we really want to have you. What we can do is 18. And if 18 is better than what the Bears are going to do, I think you can get a deal done. Let's see here. I think I got the same question last week. Doug says, I'm not sure if it was by Doug, but what will Matt Milano in Buffalo's next contract look like? You know, he's one of those players, again, that, you know, I can't say I've taken an incredibly close look at, but I think you're looking in that $11 million range or so, you know, 12. You know, he falls right in that category of all those guys that got signed last year, I think. And that's where he should wind up. Let me just check my email here. Let's see if I had anything. For some reason, I think I did, but I could be mistaken on that. Yeah, so let's see. So yeah, so the question that I had here, and I think I might have had another one too. I just don't see it in my list of stuff. Okay, so Andrew asks about J.C. Jackson on the Patriots. Basically, where would you, where would you put him in line for a contract extension? And you know, I think that's an interesting one, you know, because the Patriots are probably gonna have to do something with Gilmore next year. They did a little bit of a weird moving of some money in there. My feeling on that is, you know, people ask me why they did it. One, it was just to prevent a headache. Number two, I think by putting more money in there this year, even though they're paying him more money, I think they probably look at it saying, you know, if they want to trade him next year or even at the trade deadline, this might be more attractive to another team to do that. So I think they would be looking at moving him. Now, Gilmore, he's at 13 a year, I think. Let me just see where he ended up. Yeah, that was an interesting deal. They paid a lot up front for him. He's at 13. So I knowing the way the Patriots operate, there's no way, I don't think at least, that they would offer him over what they had paid Gilmore. Especially if Gilmore is still going to be on the roster. I think you would use that to your advantage. And basically say, well, you know, Gilmore's at 13, so we can offer you 10, something like that. It's going to depend, I guess, on how well this season goes out. You know, so last year played in almost 70% of the defensive snaps. Big thing, 5 picks, 10 passes defensed. You know, when you are a player who is able to actually make plays on a football, that always benefits you in free agency much more so than a guy who's just a pure, you know, take away the target kind of cover guy. You know, he had an interception the first game. You know, though it's against Fitzpatrick, you know, maybe anybody could do that. You know, I think if he looked at it, you know, the other problem for him is because he's undrafted, one, sometimes you can get good deals with those guys because they've never had a payday. Two, you know, he's looking at an RFA tag. Yeah, they'll probably put a second round tender, I would think, on him. You know, they could put a first just to completely insulate themselves from possibility of losing him. So I think because of that, they can negotiate those numbers down. So I would kind of say, you know, if he has a year like he did, let's say that he just has a year. Let's call it three interceptions on the season. Let's say the same, like 65 to 70% playing time. You know, I think that they'd probably be looking to offer him something 10, 11, somewhere along those lines. I think if he has a year where he, you know, has a ton of picks again or something, then you've got a whole different dynamic that kind of comes into play. But I kind of think that they would use the Gilmore deal to their advantage to bring him under that, make sure he comes in under that number. But I think it would make sense for them to do a deal. Yeah, I mean they could do a deal now if they wanted to. I don't think they will, but I think it would make sense to do a deal when he's an RFA, when you have so much more leverage than, you know, threatening with franchise tags and all that stuff. I think it would just make, you know, more sense for them to do and look at him as kind of a future at that position. So I think that was it. I may have had another email question. I'm sorry, I just can't find it right now. I forgot to make a note of it. So if I come across it, or if I just forgot about it and you're listening, you can email me it again. I promise I'll get to it next week. But I think that does it for me. So everybody have a great week. Enjoy the games. I will be drinking heavily during the Jets, I'm sure. My wife picked me up some type of pumpkin ale. I forget exactly which one it is, but I saw it was 9% alcohol, and I said, "Wow, that's definitely going to be held off for a Jets game." So we'll see how that goes. So have a great week, everyone, and I'll be back next week. So if you have any questions, you shoot them over, let me know, and we'll see how this week goes. Have a good one, everyone.